This is the Everything Financial Radio program. I am your host, Dennis Tubergen. I am here every week at this time. This is where we talk about the economy, economic cycles, and your money. I have joining me on today's program, Mr. Daniel DeSalvo. He'll be joining me in just about 45 seconds or so. And on this week's program, I'll be talking about economic data as it's reported. And we'll examine, is the reporting of this data actually accurate, or is it not really reflecting what is going on in the economy, and how can you plan for your retirement, and how can you manage your nest egg based on this data? So I think it'll be an interesting program for you. We'll offer some additional resources as well, and we do have an additional resource available as well. It is the new retirement rules class. Our next one will be taking place on March the 28th at the downtown campus of Western Michigan University. You can get more information by visiting the website, newretirementrules.com, and you can register there while capacity remains. I'm pleased to have as a first-time guest here on the program, Mr. Daniel DeSalvo, who is the assistant professor at the City College of New York. His book is Government Against Itself, Public Union Power and Its Consequences, just released, I believe, about a month ago. So, Daniel, welcome to the program.
My pleasure to be with you.
Daniel, let's talk about the book. First of all, what prompted you to write the book?
Two things. One was sort of intellectual motivation. Some of my early scholarship was on parties and campaigns, and in following campaigns and elections in the United States, I noticed, wow, these public employee unions are really spending a lot of money. They're really the boots on the ground. And I went looking for other books or scholarship that had been written about it and came up largely empty-handed. So that seemed to be that there was something missing, that we hadn't studied these groups as much as we should. The other is that was sort of a personal motivation. My grandfather and father were both union members in private sector unions and the Steel Workers and Carpenters Union. And I myself am now at a unionized workplace at the City University of New York, even though, of course, I have a PhD and a sort of level of affluence that they didn't always enjoy. So that sort of seemed like an odd transformation of the character of the labor movement that, again, hadn't received enough attention. So those were my big motivations for writing it.
So, Daniel, let's talk about, for our listeners maybe that aren't as familiar with the topic, the difference between public sector unions and private sector unions.
Yeah, this is really, I think, essential, which is that so often studies of organized labor just focus on labor unions writ large or workers is a general category, and I think that's a big analytic mistake. And there are really important differences between public and private sector unions, and they have very different effects. One big difference is their historical trajectories. Over the last 30 years, private sector unions have declined precipitously. On the other hand, public sector unions grew in the 60s and 70s, have been really stable as about 35% of all public employees ever since. So another big difference is the sources of law that govern them. Private sector unions are governed by federal law. Public sector unions are governed by state laws and local ordinances. And then really getting into the nitty-gritty is what I call two bites at the apple. Public sector unions can win things for their members through collective bargaining and through politics in a way that their private sector counterparts can't. And they can do this because they can put themselves, in some sense, on both sides of the bargaining table by contributing to the campaign coffers and the election of politicians who are then going to be sitting across the negotiating table from them. And this results, in my view, in some negative effects for the quality of state and local government in the United States.
Well, this brings up another question in my mind. To what do you attribute the fact that private sector unions have really declined in membership, while public sector unions have continued to grow their membership?
It's very interesting you raise that. Obviously, the big thing that's driving down private sector union membership is the dramatic changes that have been going on in the American economy, particularly, I mean, we say this in a big term, globalization the global economy, but really what that means is that manufacturing employment has been declining, and that was a big centerpiece of the private sector labor movement. Clearly, global competition, automation, the things that have driven down manufacturing employment don't affect the public sector. So it's not affected by that. And you could say also that in some sense, certain changes in the private sector labor movement in the 1950s, for example, pushing out many of the communists and communist organizers, sanitized the labor movement such that it could move into the public sector. So something that wasn't so great for the private sector side was actually good for the public sector.
So, Daniel, for our listeners maybe that aren't familiar with a public sector union, give us some examples as to the types of public sector employees that might belong to a union.
Yeah, I mean, here I think, again, this difference between public and private sector is key. Most of us, myself included, given my family history, walked around with an image of a union member as a kind of beefy guy in a hard hat and steel-toed boots who worked as a steel worker or a carpenter or an auto worker or a coal miner. And those were the kind of jobs for which one belonged to a union. That is really an anachronism today. The union, the labor movement has been transformed to one that largely represents teachers, firefighters, police officers, corrections officers, public university professors like myself. So if we had to have an image in our mind of a labor union worker today, it would probably be a female teacher in her 40s with a master's degree.
Interesting. Well, you had mentioned, and if you're just joining us, listeners, we're talking today with Assistant Professor Daniel DeSalvo, whose book is titled Government Against Itself, Public Union Power and Its Consequences. Let's go back to something you said earlier, Daniel, and that is that public sector unions can put themselves on both sides of the bargaining table. Can you give our listeners a specific example?
I'll give you two very similar ones. In 2006, John Corzine was running for governor of New Jersey, and he was at a rally of about 10,000 state workers, and he got a little excited, and he shouted out, "We're going to fight for a fair contract." Now, in a sense, Corzine was trying to mobilize these union workers to assist, be the kind of boots on the ground to assist his election. But Corzine, in that sense, if he was elected governor, and he was, would be management, and that is, in a sense, representing management and the taxpayer, not the union side. So that's that same idea, you could say, also played out in my own home state of New York, where the former Speaker of the State Assembly, Sheldon Silver, at a rally for the teachers' unions, promised the unions to be, in a sense, the union's best friends in Albany. Again, that's sort of the government should be the management side, not the labor side of the bargaining table, but through campaign contributions and lobbying efforts, public sector unions sort of get on both sides of the bargaining table in a way their private sector brethren can't imagine.
Daniel, we have just about a minute left in this segment, which would be a perfect amount of time for you to let the listeners know how to get their hands on your book, Government Against Itself, Public Union Power and Its Consequences.
Well, I think it's easily available on Amazon. It's also probably available on Oxford University Press's site. But those places are good, and even maybe in a few Barnes & Noble.
Well, great. Well, we're chatting today with Mr. Daniel DeSalvo, who's assistant professor at the City University of New York. His book is Government Against Itself, Public Union Power and Its Consequences. And we will be continuing our conversation with the professor in the next segment when Everything Financial Radio continues. Stay with us. This is the Everything Financial Radio program. I am your host, Dennis Tubergen. Welcome back. I'll be continuing my conversation with Assistant Professor Mr. Daniel DeSalvo when Everything Financial Radio continues. In this segment, I want to talk about one of the often quoted statistics that give us a bit of a measure as to how the economy is doing. When you want to know how the economy is doing, one of the first things that you take a look at is how many people are working. And when you want to take a look at how many people are working, you look at what the unemployment rate might be. Now, there was recently an opinion article that was written by Jim Clifton. And if you're not familiar with Mr. Clifton is the chairman and CEO at Gallup, the polling organization. Now, this article was published about a month ago on February 3, and the title of the article is The Big Lie, 5.6% Unemployment. Now, you can probably imagine what Mr. Clifton's opinion is. I want to give you a bit from the op-ed piece. Mr. Clifton says, here's something that many Americans, including some of the smartest and most educated among us, don't know. The official unemployment rate, as reported by the U.S. Department of Labor, is extremely misleading. Right now, we're hearing much celebrating from the media, the White House, and Wall Street about how unemployment is down to 5.6%. The cheerleading for this number is deafening. The media loves a comeback story. The White House wants to score political points, and Wall Street would like you to stay in the market. Mr. Clifton writes, none of them will tell you this. If you, a family member, or anyone is unemployed and has subsequently given up on finding a job, if you're so hopelessly out of work that you've stopped looking over the past 4 weeks, the Department of Labor doesn't count you as unemployed. That's right. While you're as unemployed as one can possibly be, and tragically may never find work again, you are not counted in the figure we see relentlessly reported in the news, currently 5.6%. Right now, as many as 30 million Americans are either out of work or severely underemployed. Trust me, Mr. Clifton writes, the vast majority of them aren't throwing parties to toast falling unemployment. There's another reason why the official rate is misleading. Say you're an out-of-work engineer or healthcare worker or construction worker or retail manager. If you perform a minimum of 1 hour of work in a week and are paid at least $20, maybe someone pays you to mow their lawn, for an example, you're not officially accounted as unemployed in the much-reported 5.6% headline figure. Few Americans know this. Let me repeat that, because I bet a lot of the listeners to the Everything Financial Radio program don't know that either. If you're an out-of-work professional, if you perform a minimum of 1 hour of work in a week and are paid at least $20, you're not officially counted as unemployed in the much-reported 5.6% headline rate. Yet another figure of importance, Mr. Clifton continues, that doesn't get much press. Those working part-time but wanting full-time work. He gives this example. If you have a degree in chemistry or math and are working 10 hours part-time because it's all the work you can find, in other words, you're severely underemployed, the government doesn't count you in the 5.6% that are officially unemployed. Few Americans know this. There's no other way to say this. The official unemployment rate, which cruelly overlooks the suffering of the long-term and often permanently unemployed, as well as the depressingly underemployed, Mr. Clifton concludes, amounts to a big lie. And he adds, it's a lie that has consequences. Because the great American dream is to have a job, and in recent years, America has failed to deliver that dream more than it has at any time in recent memory. A good job is an individual's primary identity, Mr. Clifton writes. Their very self-worth, their dignity, it establishes the relationship they have with their friends, community, and country. When we fail to deliver a good job that fits a citizen's talents, training, and experience, we are failing the great American dream. Gallup, Mr. Clifton's organization, defines a good job as 30-plus hours per week for an organization that provides a regular paycheck. Right now, the United States is delivering at a staggeringly low rate of 44%, which is the number of full-time jobs as a percent of the adult population. That is an alarmingly low number. In the United States today, 44% is the number of full-time jobs as a percent of the adult population, 18 years of age and older. Mr. Clifton writes, we need that to be 50% and a bare minimum of 10 million new good jobs to replenish America's middle class. Mr. Clifton concludes his op-ed piece by saying, I hear all the time that unemployment is greatly reduced, but the people aren't feeling it. When the media, talking heads, the White House, and Wall Street start reporting the truth, the percent of Americans in good jobs, jobs that are full-time and real, then we'll quit wondering why Americans aren't feeling something that doesn't remotely reflect the reality in their lives. And we'll also quit wondering what hollowed out the middle class. Now, I talk about this in my book that was published back in 2011. The book was titled Economic Consequences. And in the book, I take a look at how the unemployment rate is actually calculated. There are six measures of unemployment that are officially measured, and they're labeled from U1 to U6. The most commonly reported number, and the one that Mr. Clifton referenced in his article, his op-ed piece, is the U3 unemployment rate. That's the headline rate, which Mr. Clifton reported at 5.6%. Now, U3 is officially defined as the percentage of the civilian labor force that is unemployed and actively looking for work. The U6 measure of unemployment is the U3 measurement, the headline rate, the one we just talked about, plus discouraged workers, plus marginally attached workers, plus part-time workers. Marginally attached workers, we hear that term all the time, but what does it mean? It means workers who have given up looking for employment for various reasons. Part-time workers include those who are working part-time but would rather be working full-time. Now, John Williams of the website Shadow Government Statistics, and if you want to go check it out for yourself, the website is shadowstats.com. It is a subscription-based site. There is, however, quite a bit of free information as well listed there. Shadow Stats tracks officially reported economic data and also tracks the data using the methods that were used previously to calculate these percentages. And when you talk about unemployment, the unemployment rate. Now, Mr. Williams reports on his website that back in 1994, the way the unemployment rate was calculated changed. Now, it should come as no surprise that this was done to make the unemployment numbers look more favorable. Up until 1994, a discouraged worker was defined as someone who was willing, able, and ready to work, but had given up looking because there was no jobs to be had. In 1994, the definition was changed. This definition of a discouraged worker was changed, and it was changed to someone who had actually looked for a job in the last 4 weeks. If you hadn't looked for a job in the last 4 weeks, you're no longer considered to be part of the labor force, and if you're no longer in the labor force, then you can't be counted among those who are unemployed. Now, this affects the unemployment rate by reducing the officially reported number significantly. One visit to shadowstats.com will show you that the official unemployment rate, the U3 rate, is 5.6%. The U6 rate is somewhere north of 11%. However, Mr. Williams calculates that if you calculated the unemployment rate today the way you did pre-1994, the rate would today be 23.2%. And the people I talk to every day, that reflects a little bit more closely to what is reality and what folks are actually feeling. Now, we talk about the economy, we talk about how data is reported, we talk about how to interpret it, and we do that all in the context of helping you manage your nest egg and giving you a different perspective. We do that at our new retirement rules class, and our next class is coming up on March the 28th, which is a Saturday. I'd invite you to go to the website newretirementrules.com to get more information or to register while capacity remains. The website again, newretirementrules.com. I'll be back after these words.
Give me your money, honey. Just give me money.
Monday, Monday, Monday. Always Sunday. Welcome back to the Everything Financial Radio Program. I'm your host, Dennis Tubergen. I'm pleased to have as a first-time guest on the program today, Assistant Professor Daniel DeSalvo of the City University of New York. His book is Government Against Itself, Public Union Power and Its Consequences. I'd encourage you to check it out. Daniel, we were chatting a bit about the differences between public sector unions and private sector unions and what a typical union member looks like today in the last segment. Let's jump in and just talk about some of the effects that public sector unions have on how government functions at the state and local and even federal level.
Well, I'd say broadly speaking, I make a big claim in the book basically that unionizing our public workers has the effect of weakening the capacity of state and local government to deliver goods and services to citizens at a reasonable price. Now, to unpack that, how does that work? Well, they tend to first drive up costs, both in terms of the amount of monies paid to public employees in salary. So if you have unionized firefighters, and firefighters are unionized in 37 states, you'll tend to, in a city, you'll tend to pay those firefighters about 10% more than in places where they're not unionized. They also tend to drive up the cost of benefits, that is pensions, health care, and other benefits for public employees. So if, you unionize your firefighters in one municipality, they're going to cost about 25% more in benefits than in places where they aren't unionized. So the effect of this is then to also drive down the productivity of government. In part, unions negotiate work rules that can often constrain management, and that has the effect of making government less productive, less innovative than it otherwise would be. So you, in a sense, you're paying more for less. And third, a big thing I talk about in the book is what I call crowding out. The rising costs of pensions and health care for public employees who are retired are really squeezing state and city budgets across the country, meaning they don't have resources left over to launch new programs, to innovate, to do other things that might assist citizens in the middle class and especially the poor who rely on government. So those are three big effects I see from unionizing public employees.
Daniel, let me go back and just have you re-examine that last point that you made, because here on the program we've talked extensively about a lot of the municipal bankruptcies that we've seen over the past several years all across the country. I don't know if this is a fair question, but to what extent do these I don't know if exorbitant is the right word, but certainly these very generous benefits to public sector employees, to what extent do those benefits play a role in what we've seen?
Well, as you're in Michigan, you've been, in a sense, on the front lines of experiencing this. I mean, one big piece of what drove Detroit into bankruptcy was its legacy costs in the form of pensions for its public employees. That was a huge slice of the city's liabilities that it couldn't afford. So in this respect, public sector employees receive a lot of compensation. A lot of it is backloaded into retirement in the form of pensions and health care, which means cities and states around the country have been consuming a lot of goods and services provided by their public employees and then promising to pay for them later. And really, since the Great Recession, that bill has increasingly started to come due, and that's putting state and local budgets in a vise, meaning more money is being paid out to retired public employees, and that's not leaving over resources for services in the here and now.
So, Daniel, based on your research and what you see and what you saw as far as researching your book, what are the trends that we can expect as far as public sector unions and benefits given to public sector union employees?
Well, I think I'll give you a couple of scenarios for the future. Is one, public employees have really been, and public labor relations has really been at the center of our politics since the Great Recession. You know, Washington's been locked in gridlock, but at the state and city level, this has really been where the action has been in the last 5 years. And I'd submit that it's probably going to be central to our politics in the coming years, and you can see this in lots of places. Most clearly Wisconsin, which was a huge flashpoint for this issue, but then in Michigan itself, which passed a right-to-work law, in Indiana, which also passed a right-to-work law, recalibrating its public labor relations. You see a lot of conflict in blue states like California, Illinois, and even my home state of New York and New Jersey. So I think you're going to see persistent and ongoing conflict in cities and states around the country between governments and their employees. And maybe this will end up changing some laws in dramatic ways as it has across the Midwest. Maybe it will just be smaller and slower change in some of the big blue coastal states. Another possibility coming up would be really a dramatic shift, and that's if the Supreme Court takes up a case called Fredericks versus California Teacher Association and applies the logic that Justice Alito has laid out in two prior cases, Knox versus SEIU and Harris versus Quinn. If that happened, In effect, the Supreme Court could declare a right-to-work law for the public sector across the country, and that would really change things a lot.
So for our listeners, Daniel, that may not be familiar with a right-to-work law, explain, if you would, how a right-to-work law might affect the efficiency of a public sector union.
Unions right now, unlike other interest groups, don't have to worry about raising money from their members in places where they have what's called a fair share fees, or sometimes called agency fees. So my own workplace, if you want to become a public university professor in City University, you do that, and you don't have to join the union, but you must pay into union coffers the cost of its representation of you in collective bargaining. And those costs are usually almost identical to union dues. And that guarantees a sort of steady and stable revenue stream for the union. If you have a right-to-work law, as Michigan now does, that means that a new employee can say, if I want to join the union, I can, and I'll pay dues. If I don't want to join the union, I don't have to pay the union anything. So that sort of gives you the freedom to decide whether, you know, where you want your money to go in a way that is now would be illegal, say, in New York or New Jersey or Illinois.
So, Daniel, let's go back and revisit a case that, frankly, I'm not familiar with. You mentioned that the case Fredericks versus California Teachers Association. Can you talk about that case and what is the likelihood, in your opinion, that the Supreme Court does decide to take up that case?
Basically, this case is, again, a sort of issue that's come up in two prior cases. One I mentioned, Harris versus Quinn, which was decided this last spring. The argument in this case and the issue in that in these cases is whether requiring public employees who to pay fair share fees or agency fees, right, in places where there's not a right to work law, whether that in fact violates their First Amendment rights of freedom of association and freedom of speech. Because in a sense, collective bargaining in the public sector, because it's a different enterprise than in the private sector, it would seem that by contributing, for people who don't want to be union members, by contributing to the union coffers, the union is going to take a position in collective bargaining for, say, greater salary. And that's really a political position about the allocation of government resources, which employees might or might not agree with. So the argument here is because the activity of unions in the public sector politically is directed at the government and through collective bargaining is directed at the government, it's almost impossible to distinguish, you know, what is a political position and what isn't. And in that sense, it's so fundamentally political that it could violate individuals' free speech rights. And that's the issue for a bunch of teachers out in California. I'd say that the prospects are quite good that the court will take up this case. Whether Justice Alito can mobilize the coalition of the willing to support his arguments that he's laid out in these prior cases, I think remains to be seen.
So, Daniel, give me your opinion. You are a union employee in the public sector. Should public sector employees be allowed to unionize in light of the fact that it makes government more expensive? What's your personal opinion?
My own view is that, of course, public employees should be allowed to form associations, voluntary associations, to represent their views, to petition government, just like any other group of citizens. Those are their First Amendment rights, and I certainly wouldn't want them to be denied those. However, I do think that what we've created is a system that gives public employee unions as interest groups a lot of advantages over other interest group players in state and local government, particularly things like fair share fees and exclusive representation that really fill up their coffers and make them powerful players. So I think what we need to do is sort of make public employee unions look more like other interest groups in state and local government.
So Daniel, assuming that there is a national right to work law, assuming the Supreme Court does make that decision, will public sector unions go away, or do you see the role of public sector unions changing? Maybe they offer more employee benefits as opposed to collective bargaining. How do you see this playing out?
I think the way it would play out is you could look at states where you don't have collective bargaining in the public sector. States like Virginia, states like Utah, states where collective bargaining for public employees is very limited, like Texas. That is, you still have or the, any of the right-to-work states of the South, you still have public employee unions. They're really just associations that politic and lobby on behalf of the interests of public employees. But their membership is really confined to the people, the public employees, who care the most about this and want to be involved and engaged with it, the same way that the Sierra Club or the NRA attracts people that are interested in guns and the environment. So I think that what you would see is a decline in membership, because not everybody who is a union member today genuinely wants to be, and probably in the revenues that public employee unions take in.
Well, our guest today has been Assistant Professor Daniel DeSalvo of City University of New York. His book is Government Against Itself, Public Union Power and Its Consequences. I'd encourage you to pick the book up. Daniel, I really enjoyed our conversation today. Very enlightening, and appreciate you joining us. Hope you'll come back.
My pleasure. I'd love to.
Everything Financial Radio returns after these words. Stay with us. Welcome back to the Everything Financial Radio program. I am your host, Dennis Tubergen, and thanks again to our special guest today, Assistant Professor Daniel DeSalvo, for joining us, and I would encourage you to check out his book. You know, in this segment, I want to talk about another bit of economic data that's often reported, and this bit of economic data is often used to determine how it affects people's lifestyles, how it affects your ability to maintain your standard of living. And what we're going to talk about in this segment is the officially reported inflation rate. Now, when you think about inflation, you probably think about how much have prices gone up. In fact, you've been to the grocery store, you've probably noticed over the past 10 years or so that some of the packages of the items that you buy, maybe the price hasn't gone up, but the packages have gotten smaller. So let's talk about inflation and how the inflation rate is officially reported, and let's just see if that officially reported inflation rate does reflect accurately what you're feeling at the grocery store and what you're feeling when you're spending your paycheck or your Social Security check. And we'll also talk about the recent report that the official U.S. inflation rate is negative, meaning that we're actually seeing prices declining. So we'll jump in here and let's talk about how inflation is measured. Inflation is measured typically most often using something called the Consumer Price Index. The Consumer Price Index is produced by the Bureau of Labor Statistics. And if you're an investor, Consumer Price Index or the Consumer Price Index is a pretty important thing to understand, because it will give you some benchmark or some target that you'll need to hit to meet your financial goals. Now, there's been some controversy as to whether or not the Consumer Price Index overstates or understates inflation. There's been controversy about how inflation is measured and whether or not CPI is an appropriate measure of inflation. So what's the controversy? Well, originally, Consumer Price Index was determined by taking a basket of goods and services and comparing the price of that basket of goods and services, say, a year ago, and comparing the price of that basket of goods and services today. However, over time, the politicians decided that that may not be the best way to reflect inflation. Because if you compare a basket of goods and services a year ago and a basket of goods and services today and look at the prices over those time frames, that's really a cost of goods index. Consumer Price Index, however, after these changes, is really designed to be a cost of living index. And the difference is subtle but important, because Congress, or the Bureau of Labor Statistics, I guess authorized by Congress now, changes what's in the fixed basket of goods and services over time to more accurately reflect, according to them, consumer behavior. So let me give you an example just to make the point clear. Let's say that in this basket of goods and services, we have ribeye steaks a year ago. And now this year, when we're putting together the basket of goods and services to determine what the inflation rate actually is, we look at the price of ribeye steaks and see that the price of ribeye steaks has gone up significantly. So, someone with authority at the Bureau of Labor Statistics says, who's going to buy ribeye steaks at these prices? They're likely going to buy a cut that's a less prime cut that they can buy for a more reasonable price. So maybe they take ribeye steaks out and they throw in top sirloins. Now, because of substitution that is designed to more accurately reflect what consumers might do and how they might behave, we have an inflation rate that may be underreported. Now, John Williams, an economist that I've mentioned before on the Everything Financial Radio program, talks about this type of price manipulation, as he refers to it. He says that we're underreporting the inflation rate. In fact, the most recent inflation rate officially, when you look at the Consumer Price Index for January, is less than zero. It's negative. We're seeing deflation. We'll talk about that in just a second. Williams says that, according to his measures, the actual inflation rate is somewhere between 3 and 4%. If you take a look at the official inflation rate for 2014, in fact, if you're on Social Security, the official inflation rate helps determine what your cost of living adjustment might be. The official rate was 1.7%, but according to Williams, the actual rate was somewhere around 5% using the methodologies that used to be used. Well, certainly one of the motivations potentially to underreporting inflation is to keep the cost of entitlement programs, and I know a lot of you don't like that term, but entitlement programs like Social Security, where the benefits also ultimately linked to the inflation rate, down. If the official inflation rate was 5% instead of 1.7%, imagine how much money that would cost to keep these entitlement programs in line with the official inflation rate. Now, there's an article published, written by Martin Feldstein, and it was written by Project, or published rather, on ProjectSyndicate.org. And this was published just last week on February the 28th, and the title of the article was The Deflation Boogeyman. Now, when you look at inflation, it's the definition of inflation is really not rising prices. That's a symptom of inflation. Inflation is really an expansion of the money supply. So if there's more money out there pursuing the same amount of goods and services, one of the results, one of the symptoms is rising prices. Deflation, on the other hand, is a contraction of the money supply. Now, the money supply is actually contracting. Now, how can that be? The Fed's printed money, interest rates are at 0%. How can it be that the money supply may be contracting? Well, it's really important to understand this fundamental fact. Most money is not currency. Most money is debt. In fact, cash money, currency money, is rarely used. I'll give you a couple examples. Let's say you go buy a home and you get a mortgage from the bank to help buy your home. That money really is transferred. It's an account entry from the bank to you, to the seller of the property. Well, since over 95% of money is debt, it's important to understand that when a debt doesn't get paid, when someone defaults on a debt or walks away from a piece of real estate because it's gone down in value, when that debt is never paid, what happens is money is removed from the financial system. The money supply contracts. And when you study history, as we do here, and look at economic cycles, we know that when private sector debt levels reach a certain level, and they're at that level today, the end result is going to have to be deflation. The money supply is going to have to contract because there's one eternal truth when it comes to debt. If there's more debt that can possibly be paid, it will not all be paid. Well, the central banks around the world, like the Federal Reserve and now the European Central Bank, really don't want deflation. They're scared to death of deflation. That's why they have now in Europe, the European Central Bank has said they're going to engage in their own round of money printing. So the battle going on by these central bankers is trying to create 2% inflation, and yet none of the banks have been able to get there. They're trying to create inflation because they don't want a deflationary cycle. See, if prices begin to decline, then people put off purchases, anticipating that prices will decline further in the future, and they're going to put off a purchase until maybe that purchase becomes more affordable. So it becomes a cycle that feeds on itself. And then secondly, if you see that deflation affects wages, how much more difficult is it to pay debt that maybe you acquired in a period of inflation, but now in a period of deflation, you've got to pay off that debt potentially with lower wages? That becomes a cycle that is very, very scary for central bankers because it affects the economy. And that's outlined in this article written by Mr. Feldstein titled The Deflation Boogeyman. Now, in the United States, there was an article published on BBC News on February the 26th. The United States is experiencing negative inflation. Now, one of the big drivers for that certainly is lower fuel prices. But the consumer price index fell by 0.7% in January, almost a full percent, and it fell by 0.1% from a year earlier, the first annual drop in 5 years, the Department of Labor said. Now, we predicted that we would see deflation once the Fed began its taper, which it began in October. And we believe that this trend will likely continue given the high private sector debt levels unless the Fed engages in some additional type of money printing or quantitative easing, which we also expect they will do, although they're not talking about it whatsoever at this time. When you study economic cycles from a historical perspective, you can see that the outcomes of these policies, we believe, are largely predictable. We talk about these economic cycles at our new retirement rules class. If you've not yet attended, let me remind you as I close the program, we do have another class coming up on March the 28th. You can get more information by visiting the website, newretirementrules.com. The website again is newretirementrules.com. That's all for this week. Thanks for listening.